Thank you for listening to Enabled This Week. In the last few weeks, you might remember a couple of programs that looked at the history of blindness in art and the history of ophthalmology. Well, today it's going to be a much more general topic, the history of people who are blind. I found this very interesting article at Britannica.com, but before I begin reading the article from Britannica, I want to note that the article does not use people-first language and continues to refer to individuals as the blind. As WXXI Reach Out Radio believes that people are people first, I will be replacing references to the blind throughout the article with the adopted language of inclusivity, referring to people who are blind. So now I'll begin. Information came from www.britannica.com. The article is titled History of People Who Are Blind, with the subheadline, The Experience of Persons Affected by Blindness and the Development of Education for the Blind and Organizations Through Time. This article was written by Brian R. Miller, who's a contributor to the Encyclopedia of Disability, whose work for that encyclopedia formed the basis of his contributions to Britannica. The history of people who are blind is difficult to chart. There are a few examples before the 19th century of sustained organized efforts by people who are blind to act in concert to achieve collective goals. And prior to the 18th century, the history of people who are blind is optimistic, considering of stories of protagonists in religious and secular stories who weave in and out of popular consciousness, serve as object lessons, or provide inspiration to people who are sighted. What is left to the historian is a collection of biographies of extraordinary individuals, all the way from Homer to Helen Keller, Louis Braille to Jorge Luis Borges, which provides little in the way of a narrative thread that one can pull together to create a tapestry of the history of people who are blind. The negative historical assumption is of people who are blind as objects of charity rather than active agents in history. Occasionally, people who are blind could be found clustered in certain state or church-sanctioned professions or guilds. But in part, blindness was assumed to be a ticket to misery, a curse, or a sentence to second-class status. People who are blind, in truth, occupy no greater or lesser place in history commensurate to their numbers in the general population. There are historical examples of teachers who were blind, soldiers, religious and secular leaders, scientists, philosophers, mathematicians, historians, and a variety of other professionals. There are, as with people who are sighted, countless people who are blind who lived out their lives in quiet obscurity. Thus, it can be said that while history offers a pantheon of individuals who are blind, there exists nothing unique to people who are blind that is unknown to people who are sighted. Even so, since the 19th century, people who are blind have made concerted efforts to come together, to improve their situation, to share strategies of success, and to have a voice in society, rather than to be objects of curiosity and speculation. The next section is called People Who Are Blind in the Ancient World. It has long been assumed that in the ancient world, people who are blind enjoyed few opportunities and lived out their days in penury, as beggars or as wards of their families in the absence of any systematic state or government assistance. Historical knowledge of the lives of blind people in the pre-modern Western world is extremely limited, and it is strongly influenced by literary or religious texts. Traditional interpretations of classical literary representations hold that blindness is a punishment for social or religious transgressions, or alternatively, is the price one pays to gain spiritual vision and insight. Oedipus is often cited as an example of the former, while Tiresias may be seen as an example of the latter. References to people who are blind in classical Greek literature describe blindness as occurring through accident, through warfare, or as punishment for social or religious transgressions. Today, it is known, however, that only a very small number of cases of blindness result from accidents, and there is no evidence to support the idea that accidents would have been a major cause of blindness for those living in ancient Greece or Rome. With so few examples to draw on, most of which falsely portrays blindness as occurring from accident, literary sources do not provide adequate evidence on which to base broad assumptions about either how people who are blind lived or how people who are blind were popularly perceived as a class by their contemporaries. Religious texts of the Jewish and Christian traditions similarly provide little knowledge of actual people who were blind during the centuries on either side of the birth of Jesus. Biblical scholars debate whether blindness is to be interpreted in either spiritual or corporeal terms. Some New Testament scholars believe, for example, that depictions of Jesus healing people who are blind are meant to be seen as curing spiritual blindness, not physical blindness. Nonetheless, ancient and medieval depictions of people who were blind as either sinners or saints persisted into the modern era in the West and continued to be the subjects of religious and philosophical inquiry. Although the Greek poet Homer is often assumed to be blind, there is no evidence of whether or not he could see. Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey, does, however, feature a poet who's blind called Demodocus, who is sometimes considered a Homeric self-portrait. The names of a handful of other storytellers who are blind survive in Western literature, such as Ossian, a Celtic warrior and son of Fingal, the 3rd century king of Morven, and we have Turlough O'Carolan, who lived from 1670 to 1738. He was a harpist composer who was considered to be the last of Ireland's bards. Well-known scholars who are blind of the early Christian era include Didymus the Blind, who lived from 313 to 398. He was a theologian in Alexandria. Didymus invented a means of reading that used carved wooden letters, and he taught St. Jerome, who was widely known for the Vulgate, his Latin translation of the Bible. In the 6th century, St. Hervé, who was also called Harvey, St. Harvey, established a monastery in Brittany, which later became a shrine for musicians who were blind. Born in what is today Syria, a man named Al-Ma'ari, who lived from 793 to 1057, became a preeminent poet after experiencing a childhood disease that damaged his vision. His poetry transcended the topics of love and war and reflected a skeptical view of the world. Other important figures who were blind include Prospero Fagnani, an influential 17th century Italian canonical scholar, and the English poet, pamphleteer, and historian John Milton, who lived from 1608 to 1674. He is best known for the epic poem Paradise Lost, which was originally issued in 1667, which he wrote after he lost his sight. The next section is called People Who Were Blind During the Enlightenment. During the Enlightenment of the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe, philosophers introduced new questions about blindness and the nature of people who are blind, moving the conversation away from strictly spiritual questions toward rational interpretations of understanding and knowledge. Scholars debated whether or not people who were blind were more likely to be atheists as a result of their presumed bitterness against God over their condition. But others argued that people who were blind were closer to God, as they were spared the burden of earthly distractions because of their blindness. The English philosopher John Locke, in a work called An Essay Concerning Human Understanding that was published in 1689, this is John Locke saying that he considered the question of whether a person born blind who became sighted would be able to recognize objects that were previously known to him only by touch. Locke asserted that newly sighted people would not be able to understand the world using their new vision. Anglican bishop, philosopher, and scientist, whose name is George Berkeley, disagreed with Locke, and he argued in a work called An Essay Towards a New Theory of Vision, published in 1709, he argued that what one saw with the eye was merely the influence, not the essence, of a thing. The question was a favorite among philosophers long after Locke, as the rhetorical scenario allowed speculation as to the nature of learning and understanding. This debate was not merely rhetorical to people who were blind, however, as there were direct implications as to whether or not people who were blind could or should be educated in reading and writing and the classics. If sight was required to understand the essence of a thing, as Locke argued, then educating people who were blind was a futile experience. If understanding was generated from within, as Berkeley argued, then there was no reason that a person who was blind could not learn as well as people who are sighted. Next, we come to an English mathematician named Nicholas Saunderson, S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. Nicholas Saunderson lived from 1682 to 1739. He was someone who lived that debate. Having lost his sight at the age of one from smallpox, Nicholas Saunderson went to the University of Cambridge to study mathematics, although he did not actually attend the university as a student. Rather, he used the library, and he tutored others in mathematics and Newtonian physics. In 1711, Saunderson became the Lucasian Chair of Mathematics at Cambridge, despite his lack of formal credentials. Just a little background information. I had to look this one up. The Lucasian Chair of Mathematics is a very prestigious position. It's named after Henry Lucas from 1633, and it's one of the most famous academic posts in the whole world. It was originally occupied by Newton himself, followed by a man named Whiston, and followed by Saunderson, the one that we're talking about right now. Later in history, very recent history, Stephen Hawking occupied the Lucasian Chair of Mathematics at Cambridge. And this man, Nicholas Saunderson, did this without attending Cambridge in advance. Saunderson inherited the chair from Anglican priest mathematician William Whitston, himself having followed Sir Isaac Newton. Newton was acquainted with Saunderson and felt that Saunderson was one of the few scholars who truly understood his ideas. Got to remember that name. I haven't heard of him before. Nicholas Saunderson, big in math in early English history. The next section is called Education and the Blind. French philosopher Denis Diderot penned one of the first treatises to include significant discussion of people who are blind and education with his what's called a Letter on People Who Are Blind for the Use of Those Who Can See. This was written in 1749. The essay suggested that the sense of touch could be honed for reading with blind persons, foreshadowing the 19th century invention of the Braille writing system. Diderot included a section on Saunderson, and he emphasized the role of sensory experience in human accomplishment, espousing the idea that the ability to see was not central to the ability to understand and reason. Another influence on Diderot's philosophy of people who were blind was Parisian music sensation Melanie de Salignac, who had devised a tactile form of print to both read music and to correspond with her friends. Diderot saw de Salignac as an example of what was possible, and he argued that people who were blind could be educated so long as the educator focused on what skills the person who was blind possessed, and not on the lack of sight. As one of the most influential philosophers of French Enlightenment, Diderot provided a philosophical foundation for the education of people who were blind. In 1784, French calligraphy professor Valentin Haüy, is spelled H-A-U-Y, Valentin Haüy, this is in French, in France, he opened the first school for the blind in Paris. Haüy had been influenced by Charles Michel, who had opened the first public school for people who were deaf in the 1770s. Howie was inspired by a talented Austrian pianist who was blind. Her name is Maria Theresia von Paradis. Von Paradis showed Howie the tactile alphabet she had developed, which she used to read and write. Von Paradis had been corresponding with a German man who was blind, Johann Ludwig Weissenberg, who in turn had taught other students who were blind the finger alphabet that the two had used to write to one another. Howie appreciated that people who were blind could learn by reading with their fingers, so he developed a raised alphabet system to teach his students. Howie's methods would become the model adopted by educators of people who were blind for the next half century. Raised Roman letters were very inefficient to read, however, and Howie wanted a system that looked attractive to people who are sighted as much as he was interested in what actually worked for people who are blind. Well, the conflict between what people who are sighted asserted that the blind needed and what the blind themselves insisted really worked became the central organizing force of people who are blind in the two centuries that followed. By the early 19th century, several schools had appeared in Britain, including in Liverpool in 1791, in Edinburgh in 1793, and in Bristol in 1793. Those schools were developed along English trade school models, where students were taught a trade rather than to read and write. Johann Wilhelm Klein founded a school for people who were blind in Vienna in 1804. Klein believed that students who were blind should be integrated into the classroom with their sighted peers. So those three models that we just mentioned, Howie, English trade schools, and Klein in Vienna, drove the debate for the next century on what children who are blind should learn. Some educators believed it was better to teach a trade so that people who were blind could support themselves as adults, while others asserted that a classical education would propel people who were blind into more esteemed professions, as well as provide examples of the potential of the human capacity for learning. Just as people who were blind sparked a debate among Enlightenment philosophers over the nature of understanding in the 17th and 18th centuries, social reformers of the 19th century argued over the degree to which people who were blind could be, quote-unquote, rehabilitated or trained to take their place in the broader community as contributing citizens. American educator Samuel Gridley Howe, who was in Boston in 1831, opened the New England Institute for the Education of the Blind. This was later known as the Perkins School for the Blind. This was the second school of its kind in the United States. And this person, Samuel Gridley Howe, he argued that people who were blind could be educated and trained to become independent members of society, earning their own way in the world. Howe's school became a model for schools all around the United States. In part, Howe's success derived from his famous pupils. Laura Bridgman, a deaf and blind girl, entered Howe's school in 1837. Howe wanted to prove that anyone could learn to read and write, and he set out to teach Bridgman language through fingerspelling and raised type. Bridgman, Laura Bridgman, eventually gained fame nationally and internationally for her mastery of communication with fingerspelling and the written word. Most schools for people who were blind that were subsequently established in the United States were state-funded, marking a change from the education of people who were blind as a charitable enterprise to an entitlement paid for with tax dollars. Children who were blind continued to be educated at residential schools, apart from children who were sighted, until well into the 20th century. By the 1920s, educators and advocates for blind people had begun to argue forcibly that people who were blind ought to attend school with their sighted peers. By 1970, that idea formed the basis for a movement known as mainstreaming. with the passage of the Education for All Handicapped Children Act of 1975, and this was, by the way, the forerunner of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act in 1990, the mainstreaming of children who are blind became a right. Schools for people who are blind diminished in importance in favor of integration of students who are blind with students who were sighted. The next section is talking about people who were blind and the organizations they formed. Much of the debate about the abilities of people who were blind in the years from Diderot to Howe occurred among people who were sighted. The actual voices of people who were blind were not part of that debate. However, the advent of schools and institutes for the blind afforded them an opportunity to organize as a group for their own interests. People who were blind were able to talk to one another and learn strategies of success for living as a person who's blind. Schools and institutes served as hothouses for the development of and experimentation with new devices and systems of writing. Now, there is a paragraph inserted right here describing the development of Braille. Louis Braille, a student at the Royal Institute for the Blind, which is also called the National Institute for Blind Children, in Paris in 1820s, took a raised dot system of code brought to the school in 1821 and turned it into the most important advancement in education for people who were blind. Charles Barbier, a person who was sighted, he was a French military officer, had invented a raised dot system that was intended to allow officers to communicate with one another in the dark. The French army never adopted the system, nor did the Paris School for the Blind at first. However, Louis Braille reduced the system proposed by Barbier to only 6 dots, making it relatively simple to read with the fingertips. And he created a system of abbreviations and shorthand symbols that would allow people who are blind to read at a much faster rate. The dots looked nothing like the Roman letters they replaced, but the system was much easier for people who are blind to read. The school rejected Braille's system, in part because school administrators were reluctant to replace all the raised alphabet volumes that were created at great expense under Howey and his successors. Braille was a teacher at the school, however, and he taught his system to his students who were blind. So by the time of Braille's death in 1852, the school had finally accepted the superior Braille method of transcription. Braille's system also made it possible for people who are blind to be teachers of students who are blind, further strengthening resistance to that raised dot system by teachers who were sighted. The introduction of Braille not only revolutionized education for people who are blind, it allowed them to communicate with one another without sighted intervention. A community of alumni who were blind developed, and people who were blind began to publish their own stories in the form of memoirs intended to capture the interests of a sighted readership. Such narratives were a combination of religious inspiration and captivating details about the lives of blind people. And now we go back to the article itself. And this paragraph talks about the organization of people who are blind in the United States. By the beginning of the 20th century in the United States, people who were blind were organizing into professional associations, such as the American Association of Workers for the Blind, AAWB. This was established in 1905, and they began to agitate for more overtly political objectives in such publications as one called The Problem from 1900 to 1903, and another called Outlook for the Blind in 1907, and this was retitled New Outlook for the Blind in 1951, and it was again renamed the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness in 1977. Advocacy groups organized by activists who were blind emerged in the 1920s and 1930s in a number of U.S. states. Activists in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Colorado, and California were successful in agitating for pensions for people who were blind and public awareness efforts to inform their communities about the needs and interests of people who were blind. Those state affiliates came together in 1940 to charter the National Federation of the Blind, the NFB. The NFB organized affiliates across the United States to become the largest advocacy group of people who were blind. The NFB began publishing the Braille Monitor in 1957 and produced a number of leaders in the what they called the blind movement who advanced the objectives of the NFB and its supporters. Jacobus Ten Broeck, president of the NFB from 1940 to 1960, and Kenneth Jernigan, president of the NFB from 1968 to 1986, were galvanizing figures in this movement. Ten Broeck was a constitutional law professor who agitated on behalf of a pension for people who were blind. He divorced from the Social Security system, and Jernigan was a teacher who transformed rehabilitation services for people who were blind as the director of the Iowa Commission for the Blind from 1958 to 1978. In 1961, the American Council of the Blind, the ACB, was established by former members of the NFB who disagreed with the direction and leadership of that organization. The ACB publishes what's called the Braille Forum. And this ends the article titled History of People Who Are Blind, written by Brian Miller and the editors of Encyclopedia Britannica. And now, switching to information from the website biography.com, the question is asked, who was Homer? The Greek poet Homer was born sometime between the 12th and the 8th century BC, somewhere on the coast of Asia Minor, maybe. He is famous for the epic poems The Iliad and The Odyssey, which have had an enormous effect on Western culture, but very little is known about their alleged author. Homer is a mystery. The Greek epic poet, credited with the enduring epic tales, is an enigma insofar as actual facts of his life go. Some scholars believe him to be one man. Others think these iconic stories were created by a group. A variation on the group idea stems from the fact that storytelling was an oral tradition, and Homer compiled the stories and then recited them from memory. Homer's style, whoever he was, falls more in the category of minstrel poet or balladeer, as opposed to a cultivated poet who is the product of a fervent literary movement, such as Virgil or Shakespeare was. These stories have repetitive elements, almost like a chorus or refrain, which suggests a musical element. However, Homer's works are designated as epic rather than lyric poetry, which was originally recited with a lyre in hand, much in the same vein as spoken word performances. All this speculation about who he was has inevitably led to what is known as the Homeric question, whether he actually existed at all. This is often considered to be the greatest literary mystery. Well, to end the program today, I have a quote for you to think about. Well, it's from Homer, of course. Light is the task where many share the toil. Loosely translated, many hands make light work. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week.